Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, welcome to Conversations. Duncan McNabb is a journalist and a writer. He used to be a policeman and a private eye as well. When he was quite little, though, his uncle Ken used to give him stories, little snippets of his exploits in the Second World War. His uncle Ken told him about the exotic campaign that he fought in Ethiopia against Mussolini's Italian army. And the stories were true. Now, you might be thinking right now, I didn't know Australians fought in Ethiopia, and I didn't either until now. But it turns out that a handful of Australians, including Duncan's uncle, led a brilliant and successful secret guerrilla campaign that helped drive Mussolini's army out of that part of Africa. And what they lacked in numbers, they made up for in guile, bravery, brilliance, and sheer bluff. It's a great story. Duncan McNabb's book is called Mission 101, The Untold Story of Five Australians' Extraordinary War in Ethiopia. Duncan McNabb, hello.
Hello, Richard. How are you?
Extremely well, sir. Now, tell me about getting this story from your Uncle Ken, as he was. How old were you around about this time?
My uncle died when I was 10, but I spent a lot of time with him from about the age of five onwards. And he could always, I suppose, you know, young kid, particularly at that time in the early 60s in Australia, you kept pestering about his war stories because there's always been this flavour that Ken was something pretty special. So I pestered the living bejesus out of him. He was one of those Australian blokes who just didn't like to talk. But he eventually gave in, and so I heard snippets, spurred on also by his wife, my dear aunt, who also was very keen on his exploits. And he told me stories about he and a group of his mates who had joined up very, very early in the war, amongst the first to join. They were on the first convoy of troops out of Australia, and while all of his colleagues in the 2nd AF went off to become rats of Tobruk, Ken and four of his mates ended up going into Ethiopia on what was a highly secret mission at that time, and not single-handedly, but pretty close to single-handedly, gave the Italians a terrible scare, which eventually saw them shoved out of Ethiopia. It was a great yarn, and it stuck with me for years, and I started researching it again quite recently, and found that not only was it an interesting story, it was all true, and there were some wonderful snippets in it that we had no idea about.
How colourful were these snippets he used to give you when you were little?
Well, he used to. The thing that I always remembered is he said we were tracking through this appalling wilderness. It was stinking hot. We were being attacked by fleas, snakes. Giraffes were wandering past. We had camels laden with bits and pieces. We ran out of water. So as the camels died in this appalling trek, we'd cut them up, drink the water from their hump, and sometimes we drank their blood just to keep going. I mean, if you're a kid, that's just absolutely wonderful.
Wow, Uncle Ken, that's great, yeah.
And then a couple of years later, I'm doing some research, and I think, God, it was true.
There it all is. What was your uncle's life like before he went to war?
Before going to war, he was a well-to-do man from Newcastle in New South Wales. Family were very affluent. Ken, I don't think, was terribly busy working. The family had plenty of cash. But he was a great sportsman. He was a fullback for Australia against the All Blacks in one particular outing. One of those blokes who just thoroughly enjoyed his sport. Had a good life in Sydney. He was always dining in some of the better restaurants. An attractive, dashing human being. Bit of a playboy, but just an engaging, funny man. And people warmed to him very quickly.
So what happened when war broke out?
He and the other fellows in the story were actually among the first to join in September, October of 1939. They all volunteered. They went to training together in Sydney at the Ingleburn Army Base, which was being hastily cobbled together to fight a war. And at the beginning of January, they piled on board some old P&O liners and went tootling off towards the Middle East to God knows what, because when they got there, it hadn't been quite decided where they'd end up. So they were sort of cooling their heels, practicing their gunnery skills and waiting for war to come their way or them to come in the war's way.
Now, while he was on that first convoy out of Australia to head off to the Middle East, he met some colleagues, and these were the men who were going to be part, he didn't know this at the time, of course, but the men who were going to be part of this handful of comrades that fought this guerrilla campaign.
Absolutely. He trained with a fellow called Bill Howell, Ted Boddy, who was a well-known Australian sheep man. Bill Howell was from outback Queensland pretty much of his life. He worked on a station out there. And Ron Wood, who was also a former rubber planter from Papua New Guinea. And he joined up with them. And then on board the boat, they met their soon-to-be officer, a fellow called Alan Brown, who worked for the Commonwealth Bank and later became a senior tax official in Australia. They got on terribly well. Alan Brown realised he had some fairly lovable rogues in his charge, and he was good at handling them, I think. So these five.
What do you mean by good at handling them?
Well, I think he realised they had skills that were quite fascinating, but they're not the sort of people that would respond remarkably well to military discipline. So Brown handled them smartly rather than militarily, I think. So they loved him, he loved them, and they got on beautifully. So when they got to the Middle East, there was a fairly cohesive friendship in place, and they respected each other.
So there was this bond between them then, even before they were sent on this mission, of which they couldn't possibly know about.
Absolutely. They were very close at that point.
Once they arrived, where were they put in the Middle East to begin with?
When they arrived, the convoy arrived at the top of Suez, and they were then carted off to El Kantara, which was very close to where the Light Horse were at Beersheba back in World War One. They set up little camps there.
This is Palestine, is it, as
in,
it was then?
In Palestine, yeah. Weekends away, for example, on a bit of recreation, they'd go into Jerusalem. Quite avid tourists, these guys. And after a while, they were then sent to Haifa, which is the to guard the large oil refinery there, which is where Alan Brown met the first Coptic Egyptian, Coptic Ethiopian priest that would pretty much change the next year of their lives.
Okay, so while they're around the Middle East too, they're stationed there, this is where nothing's really happening, is it, though? They're not really being sent off to fight because no one quite knows what to do with them, as you say. What are they being trained in while they're there in the Middle East?
These fellows are all gunnery experts. They learned how to use the very large guns, big field pieces. When they were sent to Haifa, they thought they were being downgraded slightly because they had only little anti-aircraft guns to play with, which came in handy when the Italians actually attacked Haifa in one of the first outings of the war. And then they were sent back to Cairo later on with their large guns to blow things up.
So they were given what was effectively a fair bit of preparation in guerrilla tactics at this point?
Yeah, when they'd finally been told these five fellows were going to be hived off and seconded on this secret mission to Ethiopia, when they weren't even too sure where Ethiopia was at that point, I think, they were taken off to a desert camp and learnt guerrilla tactics from the UK. A lot of them, interestingly enough, were based on what T. Lawrence had gotten up to in the First World War. So Lawrence of Arabia, he makes a very strong appearance. How to blow up a train. Interestingly enough, one of their camps was very close to one of the train sites that Lawrence of Arabia had obliterated. How to make bombs, how to live off the land, how to foster insurrection amongst the locals. That was their training.
Duncan McNabb is my guest today. He's written the true story of his uncle's exploits in the Second World War, who was part of a handful of men who formed a secret mission in Ethiopia, in East Africa, designed to terrorise the Italian occupation of Mussolini's Italian troops then, and eventually drive them out of Africa, a campaign that was wholly successful. And his book about his uncle's mission is called Mission 101. So there they are, they're in the Middle East, they're cooling their heels, they're being sent from place to place to place. And this is, as you say, when their commanding officer, Alan Brown, bumps into a priest.
He does.
An Ethiopian Orthodox priest, or a Coptic priest, or something like that?
Yeah. Yes.
Tell me how that comes about and what he learns from the priest.
Brown and the other guys, too, were, as I said, inveterate travellers and quite nosy, and they're in this utterly exotic place. I mean, they've come from Sydney and rural New South Wales and outback Queensland, and here they are in this port city of Haifa. What an extraordinary change in their lives. And so they're looking around, and Brown is an affable human being, and he encounters this Ethiopian priest, and they get to talking. You know, it's the average Australian on tour, chat to anybody. The priest tells him about how the priest and many of his countrymen had fled in 35 and 36 when the Italians came knocking. He tells them terrible stories of what the Italians did, and it was the Italian invasion of Ethiopia was utterly brutal. This is not the opera and food-loving people we pictured them as. This was Mussolini, who was just a jackbooted thug. They used chemical warfare. They broke out the mustard gas supplies from World War I and used it on Ethiopians who were armed at best with geriatric rifles. So as tanks, aerial warfare and chemicals started coming their way, the country was crushed.
So this all happened, it happened well before the outbreak of the Second World War, yeah. The invasion of Ethiopia by the Italians. Why did Mussolini want Ethiopia anyway?
Mussolini was obviously a megalomaniac. Two of the things I found were his driving forces. One, Ethiopia was strategically significant because he already had a chunk of Somalia, which was to the right of Ethiopia, Eritrea to the left. He had Libya and other bits and pieces on the other side of Africa. So he was planning on getting the middle bits as well, which would give him domination of the north of North Africa.
All right, he wanted all the same colours on the Monopoly board, did he?
Got it, yeah.
Right, yeah. All them all in the same street, yeah.
Yeah, and back in the 1896, I think it was, the Italians had had a crack at Ethiopia before and had been resoundingly beaten. And so Mussolini was of the view that it was about time for payback.
So Mussolini in 1935-36 sent his forces into Ethiopia,
yep,
and completely overwhelmed them. He used chemical warfare.
Yeah, Mussolini was they broke out the old mustard gas supplies from World War I, fitted them to aircraft and sprayed them on the Ethiopian troops and Ethiopian villages. I think Haile Selassie, who was the emperor, when he addressed the League of Nations to try and get some support, described it as the screaming terror from the skies, I think it was, or something like that. And just literally, it's one of the first usages of chemical warfare from aircraft. And just appalling.
Now we have to talk about Haile Selassie, who was the king of Ethiopia at the time, one of the most colourful figures in the last century anywhere, really. I think you said before we went on, the only Ethiopian anyone had ever heard of, I think, at that point. Tell me a bit about him and how he was forced to flee from Ethiopia.
Haile Selassie was, I suppose, a little tiny little fellow with a big beard, as a lot of Ethiopians had.
Like how tall are we talking about here?
Around about, way up about 5'1".
Oh, really?
He was a wee thing.
Tiny.
Yeah, quite enigmatic, apparently, but long hair flowing, but a bit of a bald patch at the front. Loved uniforms, but quite a dashing man, schooled in France. He changed the face of Ethiopia, or tried to change. It was originally a feudal society. He kept it reasonably feudal, but at the same time introduced education, medical programs for people. He tried to educate his population. That's probably his greatest legacy. And he started building the capital, Addis Ababa, and modernising it, pretty much. He also stepped onto the world stage as a member of the League of Nations. And he was Ethiopia at that stage was one of the few nations in Africa that wasn't a colony. So he carried a bit of clout with him. He got invited to all the right parties, royal weddings and so on and so forth. And at his coronation back in the early 30s, the world was well represented. UK was there, Britain was there, Australia was there. They all sent the various heads of state and all that sort of thing. So it was a big splash. He was well known.
So he's there, King of Ethiopia, and Mussolini said, I'll have that. And out you go. So he got out just in time, didn't he?
He did. The Ethiopian invasion started in about October 1935, and in May 1936 it was pretty much all over. Haile Selassie decided that it was probably better to fight the battle from exile and do it diplomatically through the League of Nations, a big mistake. So he fled on a train which took him to Djibouti in Somalia, and then a British warship picked him up and took him eventually to London.
Now, he goes to London, and the Italians' invasion is completely successful. They've won by committing all sorts of atrocities. Mm. It's kind of a nightmare. Now, the League of Nations is around about this time,
yes,
as you say. This is the organisation, it's the predecessor of the United Nations that we have now, that was formed to stop this kind of thing from happening. This is the very thing that the League of Nations is there to prevent from happening. Haile Selassie makes a speech to the United Nations, and what happens then?
Absolutely nothing. The United Nations pretty much ignored him. They tried sanctions. They tried to sanction provision of aluminium to Italy for making munitions. Sadly, Italy actually made its own aluminium, so there was no point to that. The League of Nations also didn't have as a member the US, so any sanctions were looking a bit silly. The United Nations pretty much dropped him straight like a hot potato. And sadly, the British and the French persuaded the League of Nations to introduce this strange pact called the Hall of Laval Pact, where one of the British Foreign Minister and the French Prime Minister got together to decide that a reasonable solution to this is to ignore Ethiopia. We'll split it up, give Italy the bits they want. We'll leave a little bit for Ethiopia, the bit that no one really wanted, not even the Ethiopians. And that'll appease Mussolini. It'll try and stop him or try and persuade him to be more kind towards the British and the French and not so fond of Hitler. That was a huge error. That pact didn't go through.
So this is why the reason why I bring this up is because this is a key moment. Ethiopia's moment here is a key moment in world history, because this is the moment when Hitler and Mussolini decide, since Mussolini can run right over Ethiopia, no one's going to do a thing, they decide that the democracies are weak and will do nothing to stop them.
Precisely. And so rather than appeasing Mussolini, it was almost a WikiLeaks moment, because the press got a hold of this bizarre pact and the whole thing just blew sky high.
Churchill was on the backbench in the House of Commons warning darkly about the rise of Hitler and Mussolini. What was his response to all of this?
Churchill was utterly appalled by it. And I think for Churchill, it was just another one of those moments where he said, well, you know, what a fine mess you're getting us into, but no one's listening.
And no one did listen.
No.
So there they are. The Italians have overrun Abyssinia, which had then become Ethiopia, as it's now called. And there's nothing anyone is prepared to do about it up until this point. So war has broken out, but Italy isn't in the war right at the start, is it?
No. Italy waited for about 9 months or so, back into the middle of 1941, before they joined. No, I have no idea why. He was just sort of cruising around watching. This is, I suppose, in part it's to what some historians used to describe as the phony war. It'll all be over by Christmas, don't worry.
So at this point is when the five Australians, led by their commanding officer, learn from this Ethiopian priest what's been happening to his country.
Yes.
So when Alan Brown, the commanding officer, hears from the priest about the rape and pillaging of his own of Ethiopia, what does he do then, Duncan?
Well, the timing's good, because this is about the time the Italians have actually come into the war. So while Alan's chatting to the priest, the Italians have now become a player in the Axis forces. Brown is appalled, talks to his mates, and he says, you know, I think I have a cunning plan. If we go in and exercise guerrilla warfare, we might just be able to make a dent in the Italians. And I think Brown was a bit of an historian, had read what the Boers had been up to in South Africa in that campaign. So having persuaded his five blokes, it didn't take much persuading to come along with him. Brown starts pestering his Australian superiors or anyone he can lay his hands on, saying that this is what we should be doing. We should be looking to Ethiopia. Here's a place we should be destabilising so we can get going in there, get the Italians out. He was blithely ignored by most of them. But a little bit later on, finally someone noticed, and it came, his plan came under notice of a fellow called Cawthorne, who was an Australian officer who was running intelligence for the British. I think he later became the head of ASIO. He thought, it's interesting, because he also was aware that at the same time, a very small group of Britons were planning precisely the same thing, and their plans were well advanced. So in the Australians, the Brits had a perfect synergy. Bring the Australians on board, and off they go under British control. So the Australians were seconded to the British Army, and Brown's plans coincided beautifully with what the British had been planning. So off they went on their what started as an adventure.
So this is when they get trained in guerrilla warfare?
Precisely.
And then they're ready to go.
Absolutely.
So it's the five men, is it?
Just five.
Just the five men?
Just five.
Including your uncle?
Mm-hmm.
Where are they sent?
They start their journey from Cairo. After they've had their training, they go from Cairo by paddle, steamer and train down the Nile to Khartoum.
In Sudan?
Yeah, Khartoum in the Sudan was at that stage HQ of British Sudan. It was where all the major players were seated. It's where Anthony Eden, the foreign secretary, was often plotting with the generals and so on and so forth. Everyone was focused on Sudan and very much in Khartoum. And historically, Khartoum had been a British stronghold for at least half a century. And that's where the mission was brought together. They met the other fellows that would go into Ethiopia behind them. They also were given a selection of Ethiopian refugees and local Sudanese troops who were quite happy to form their merry band. And the Australians started training their men, which was curious itself, because the Australians didn't speak a word of Ethiopian or any Arabic. So they started training their fellows, and these fellows would then follow them in, about 200 all up.
Did they get any language at all once they were there?
Yeah, they picked up something called Sudan Arabic, apparently, which is a language that covers Ethiopian Amharic and sort of like a cheat's guide to Arabic.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there they are. They're all. Well, that was the plan for them to go across the desert into Ethiopia and meet up with local resistance. Was there a resistance within Ethiopia at that time for them?
Yeah, there was. The precursor to their arrival was the head of the mission, a fellow called Dan Sanford, had gone in a little bit earlier and had just set up base camps and had began talking to his old colleagues. He was an old foreign office man who'd been there before. So he had a reasonable network, and he was chatting to them. The idea was that the Australians and the others in this group that would follow them would go in, say hello to Dan, and then head off into the Ethiopian highlands to do their level best to find sympathisers, train them, equip them, and bribe them if necessary.
How much did their colleagues or anyone else know about this secret mission into Ethiopia?
Until about end of January 1940, it was a huge secret. And it's a curiosity, too, that the five Australians didn't know that part of the advance party had been a fellow called Arnold Weinholt, who was a former member of the House of Representatives for the seat of Moreton and a two-time Queensland politician as well. And Arnold had gone in the very early parties and had been, unfortunately, killed in about September of 1940. Just as our fellows were training up for it, poor old Arnold Weinholt met his maker.
So once the five Australians get to Khartoum, is that when they find out about their mission? Do they even know about their mission up until this point?
Yeah, one of the fellows, I think Bill Howe, wrote to his mother and said, we're going somewhere in Africa. So they had no clear idea that they were going into Ethiopia, although they thought that was the case. But certainly they had no idea of this strange route they were going through, which is a trek through this ghastly wilderness, and then up a 14,000-foot escarpment before they finally get to the Ethiopian highlands where they're about to operate.
What did they set out with? What were they equipped with once they set out on camel?
They set out on camels and donkeys, or mules, I'm sorry, which, considering the size of some of the Australians, the mules looked pretty silly. They'd be dragging their feet on the ground. Yeah, the mules were about 3 feet high, and Alan Brown was about 6'4", so it wasn't quite the happy arrangement. All camels, which none of them had any idea how to ride, laden with supplies, a couple of hundred local troops to give them a hand. No one really knew where they were going. They were navigating through country that wasn't well mapped, pretty much with a compass, and there's a mountain over there that looks right, let's head towards it.
Nonetheless, they were very well trained.
Oh, beautifully. They knew how to blow things up and shoot at things. They were very, very competent.
They had lots of ammunition.
They had lots of ammunition, lots of supplies, lots of hand grenades, explosives, all sorts of things.
And cash.
Alan Brown had a chunk of cash, and he was very proudly at the end of this, said that he'd only spent £200 to wage war in Ethiopia, and being a good later tax officer, came back with all the appropriate receipts.
Oh. How lovely. So there they are going across the desert of Sudan towards Ethiopia. This is an amazing trek. And these stories your uncle had told you as a kid about camels dying under them and drinking the camel's blood, that's all true. Is it? They did all that to survive?
Well, they did, because the trek was just so ghastly and they really didn't know what they were walking into. And when I read this, and later I read some research, that the parties that follow them used the dead camels as a means of navigation.
Oh, really? That's we can trace them by the trail of dead camels.
The smell followed by the sight, unfortunately.
Did the Italians start to get wind of their mission at this point?
The Italians had heard that this vast force was making its way in, little realising it was five Australians and a couple of hundred troops. And they were very apprehensive about it. And then when the Australians first started wreaking havoc by blowing them up in the middle of the night, attacking their convoys out of nowhere, the Italians thought, my God, what's going on? So they immediately retreated to the forts and became very apprehensive, which is where the Australians then decided, well, we'll go and attack the forts as well.
How unpopular were the occupying Italians with the local Ethiopians?
There's a bit of a mixed bag. The broad Ethiopian population didn't like them at all, obviously, after such a brutal colonisation. But there are also quite a lot of opportunists, I think, who didn't like Haile Selassie, had been pushed around by him, in their view. And so when the Italians arrived, they sided with him. And the area in which the guys were operating was pretty much under the control of a gentleman who Haile Selassie didn't like. He'd been imprisoned by Haile Selassie. So when the Italians turned up, he thought, well, you know, these fellows look charming, I'll side with them.
What were their specific targets once they got over the mountain and into the land of milk and honey, as Ethiopia is known as?
Their targets were to disrupt the Italians as much as possible. One of the few roads in Ethiopia, and still one of the few roads in Ethiopia, runs from Addis Ababa to a place called Lake Tana, which is the area in which the guys are operating. Their main task was to, when they weren't sort of getting colleagues to give them a hand, was to set traps on the road, attack convoys. The Italians were, of course, highly mobile in Ethiopia. So attacking their convoys in the middle of the night, blowing up the road, mining the road, sweeping out of nowhere. The Australians in this did something, I suppose, these days you hear this term shock and awe, where you just attack swiftly out of nowhere and violently, and that's exactly what the Australians were doing.
Weren't they incredibly conspicuous, given that they don't look like Ethiopians?
They like to attack at night, which may have helped, but the five of them decided fairly early on that growing these luxuriant beards might give them a little bit of cover. And so there's a lovely picture of my uncle covered in so much facial hair you could barely see his eyes. And that gave him a little bit of cover, but there's pictures of them I've seen where they're still wearing their Australian uniform with a slouch hat, so the beards probably weren't that great a disguise.
So a little bit of Lawrence of Arabia, but so far and no further. In other words, dressing like the locals.
No. They didn't slip. I think there's a lovely local gown, which is a flowing white robe that the Ethiopians still wear. The lads didn't wear those. They were still in shorts, boots, and bush hats.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Duncan McNabb is my guest today. Duncan, when he was a little kid, used to hear stories from his Uncle Ken about his strange and exotic war exploits during the Second World War, telling stories of being in Ethiopia in East Africa during the Second World War, riding camels, drinking their blood to survive, and then taking part in all sorts of daring guerrilla raids to drive the Mussolini's Italian army out of their occupation of Ethiopia. Duncan went out, researched the story, and found this great untold story of the Second World War. His book is called Mission 101, The Untold Story of Five Australians' Extraordinary War in Ethiopia. So the men are in, your uncle and his friends are now in Ethiopia, and they begin this campaign, you say, bombing bridges, causing huge disruption, going from place to place. How did they make connections with the locals, the local resistance forces?
They had some original guidance from this old Foreign Office chap who had established a sort of base in Ethiopia, and the plan was at that stage that they would be successful, a larger force would wander through, and Haile Selassie would bring up the rear and be reinstated. That was the overall plan. They had some rough guidance. They had some intelligence from this old Foreign Office chap, Dan Stanford. And then they literally just went to villages and said something along the lines of, hello, here we are, want to give us a hand? And as we said, they had munitions, they had training, they had new firearms, they had lots of things that blew up, and they had a stock of cash if they needed it. So they found people who were partisan, who were happy to join them, and then they gave them some training and off they went.
Meanwhile, so much for their top secret mission, word started to get out about their exploits. Was there a campaign of misinformation going on?
I think at the time, and this is a bit of a guess on my part, but I looked at a lovely press release down at the War Memorial, which was fascinating, and said, for US market. And I thought, this is an attempt, I think, by the British military to try and get the Americans a little closer to coming and joining the party.
Oh, this was at a time before the Americans had come
in. Yeah, it was before the Americans had come in, and Suez Canal, apparently Roosevelt was quite concerned that if the Italians continued to dominate North Africa, as they were at the time, he wasn't sending anything through Suez that had an American flag attached to it. And that Suez was a lifeline for the British military. So they were trying to persuade Roosevelt possibly to come into the war, but certainly that everything was looking very much in British favour in that part of the world.
Yeah, they had to persuade the Americans. There was a campaign to persuade the Americans that it wasn't a lost cause.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if you don't want to join us yet, then by all means keep the supplies coming through. So that that little tiny bit of Africa in which Ethiopia is the centre was strategically very important. So the news of the lads' exploits somehow managed to leak out, and somehow they managed to actually, the press, within hours, by the look of it, or as fast as a telex machine might have worked in those days, have tracked down a couple of potential people like Ron Wood's girlfriend, Ken Burke's mother, Ken Burke's brother-in-law, who was the later Air Vice Marshal Jack McCauley, who was this unnamed officer who seemed to know an awful lot about the fellas. And all of a sudden there's a story appearing in, I think, the Daily Telegraph, and then filtered through the other newspapers in Australia, of these five young chaps in Ethiopia doing terrific work.
Meanwhile, what was the effect of their destabilisation, their guerrilla tactics having on Ethiopian recruits to the Italian army?
The as things got thicker in the fighting, the Ethiopians and natives who joined the Italians as part of their sort of native army, and the Eritreans for that matter too, decided that maybe it wasn't a great thing to stay. So what they noticed as their campaign progressed is that the level of desertions kept getting bigger and bigger. The problem they faced is quite often they desert and say, hey, can we work for you? So there was always this difficulty of feeding them, supplying them, and trusting them, of course.
So while all this is going on, the campaign seems to be having its effect on morale on the occupying Italians. There are several great stories, great, great, fantastic stories about attacks on forts by this handful of Australian troops with the Ethiopian locals. Tell me about the attack on the Italian garrison at Injibera, if I pronounced that correctly.
Yeah, Ethiopian place names are a removable feast. Injibera, the road between Addis Ababa stretches all the way up into Eritrea. It is the lifeline of the country, and militarily in those days it was one of the few competent sealed roads. Lovely road these days. Cuts through the Nile Gorge, which is a spectacular piece of geography. It's like the Grand Canyon, only I think a little almost sexier. Anyway, they've established this great road, and they've got fortifications all the way along it, just in case someone did prove troublesome. One of the major forts, and the first fort that Brown attacked, was first at Injibera. The Australians have pioneered, I think, at this point, what the Special Operations Executive would use later in Europe to great effect, and it's using these small groups of people, but they would then attack in the middle of the night when the Italians were hopefully all asleep and there's a couple of dozing guards, and they would come in like banshees. Ken Burke would race towards the fort walls, lobbing hand grenades and homemade bombs over at the Italians. Mortars would be flying through the night. Machine guns whistling past them, scare the living bejesus out of them. Just absolutely terrorise them and then retract during daytime, wait a little bit longer, and then come back the next day in the middle of the night at a different time and do it all again. The Italians eventually at Injibera decided that this wasn't fun at all, so they thought they'd retreat, which they wisely did, to another fort further up the road, which was a little bit safer for them.
Well, they just legged it out of there,
didn't they? Yeah, they weren't very pleased. And they legged it out of there. They were so concerned after this first attack. It had never happened in Ethiopia before. They were sitting there quite comfortably having a glass of wine and some pasta, thought it was all fine, until the Australians ruined their party. So they, after putting up a bit of a fight, and I think at Injibera Fort, they actually thought they were being attacked by an air force, which wasn't quite right. So they legged it out the next morning, and the Australians wandered in and thought, this is nice, they've left lots of food supplies, some decent wine. And they were then joined by a couple of South Africans in the same mission who were following them, and they turned up. So they chucked a dinner party.
What did they eat at this dinner party?
I think they had some mushrooms, which one later commented might have been a bit dodgy. They had the native cooks doing some chicken. They had some pasta. They had some decent parmesan cheese. And I think from memory they had some brandy left over. So they just sat around and had a very pleasant dinner party and thought, well, this is all quite nice. Let's where to next? Just one of those in the middle of an absolutely appalling war, just to have a break and have some normality.
I know, particularly with no casualties too, isn't
no
that
casualties.
Nice too?
Yes, they were. These guys were remarkable. Their entire campaign, they lost literally a handful of native troops.
And that's it. I mean, when you're going and expecting a bitter, bloody battle against forces much larger than yourself, in the end, no one gets killed, and you walk in and you have a sumptuous dinner party. That's not too bad
Way to run a war.
Indeed. If only we're always like that, yeah. What was your sense of hearing the accounts of the men at that time there? Were they conscious of the fact they were in this ancient civilization? I mean, Ethiopia is the home of, I might be wrong on this, the oldest continuing Christian culture in the world.
I think that's right. Ancient culture there.
Mm. I mean, there are rumours that it's the home of the Ark of the Covenants, you know, Indiana Jones.
Just nearby in this place called Lake Tana, only 100 kilometres or so from where the lads were. Yeah, allegedly, the Ark of the Covenant spent quite some time in an island in the middle of Lake Tana, which is this gigantic. Gigantic lake, which is full of hippopotamuses or hippopotami or whatever, and crocodiles. You can actually see them swimming around as you tour the lake. It's quite fascinating. And the Ark was apparently there. I don't know whether the Australians knew about the Ark, but there's certainly the dominance of the church was very clear to them. And but of course, I don't think any of them knew where Ethiopia really was, to be honest.
Yeah, nonetheless, they must have been flabbergasted. I mean, here they are amongst, you know, giraffes and hippopotami and maybe lions as well, stuff they've had out of storybooks and from their Bible stories too. It must have been kind of mind-blowing for them.
Absolutely, but I suppose that exuberance that they would have had at that, it was tempered slightly by the fact that when they went through, the place was just miserable. The weather was utterly appalling. I mean, they've gone from scorching temperatures, sand and all manner of horrible things attacking them down on the wilderness. They've climbed up 14,000 feet. They arrive in Ethiopia in the middle of winter. And I know we have pictures of Ethiopian air mines of sort of desert and sand and miserable. But in winter, it's bloody cold. It's
like Melbourne there is or something.
Look, make Melbourne look good. It's more London. Cold, miserable, blizzards, horrible.
Blizzards. Ethiopia.
Yeah, and these guys are out in a pair of shorts.
That'll take the edge off the good time you would otherwise be having. So, meanwhile, Haile Selassie, the king of Ethiopia who's gone into exile, when did he make his move to return to Ethiopia, given that... Because the British army is coming in behind these men, isn't it? And working very successfully.
They had... the British tried a three-pronged approach. They were coming... They were attacking the north of Ethiopia, which to try and get Eritrea, which was an Italian stronghold. Others were coming in from Somalia, very large forces. I mean, seriously, big army. But the key to Ethiopia was the highlands where our lads were, and they were in the middle of it. So that's why they took the guerrilla force in there to soften the place up before the other armies could join together and recapture Addis Ababa, which is the jewel in their crown. So the strategic importance of what they're doing was extraordinary.
So how did Haile Selassie come back?
Well, he was following them. He was about a month behind, broadly speaking. The lads have come into Ethiopia about a month behind with the main forces, Haile Selassie. They eventually caught up. And there's a picture of lovely pictures of I've seen of Haile Selassie in an open Ford car, knee-deep in mud, just driving through these appalling conditions and then trying to, on camelback, getting up through the 14,000-foot up and 14,000-foot escarpment, followed by his black-clad priest, I might say.
So eventually was he able to return in some style into the country?
They had the last major battle of this campaign was a place called Deborah Marcos, which is near the Blue Nile Gorge, which is where Haile Selassie was reunited with the bloke that didn't like him very much. And after a large battle there, which featured the Australians, they retook Deborah Marcos. And by that stage, the large British forces coming through Somalia were on the cusp of retaking Addis Ababa. So when things had stabilised, and pretty much 5 years to the day since he'd left, he returned to Addis Ababa in a motorcade. Addis Ababa is in a bit of a gully, surrounded by these magnificent hills, covered, interestingly enough, in Australian gum trees, which had been imported there years beforehand, and they just couldn't stop them growing. So there's Haile Selassie and this entourage come sweeping down the hillside into Addis Ababa. The Australians, unfortunately, weren't there. They were chasing the remaining Italians on this remarkable jaunt through the Ethiopian highlands to try and crush the last Italian troops.
Duncan McNabb is here if you've just joined us. Duncan's telling the story of his uncle and his four colleagues, a remarkable true story of their guerrilla campaign, their secret guerrilla campaign through Ethiopia during the Second World War to drive out the Italian army, Mussolini's army, which had occupied the country. Now, this is my favourite story in the whole thing, which is the fort at Mota, I think it's called.
Yes.
They arrived there, your uncle and his four... No, it was just your uncle and the commanding officer at this point, wasn't it?
Alan Brown, Ken Burke and 19 of their troops.
So two Australians, 19 Ethiopian troops arrived at a fort that was garrisoned by how many Italian soldiers?
About 2,500.
2,500 soldiers. They fronted up there to try and somehow winkle them out of their garrison. Tell me about how that story unfolds, because it's a lovely story.
Brown and Burke had originally been in Deborah Marcos and with Haile Selassie, which is where my uncle actually got to know the emperor quite well. They were dispatched off to deal with this fort called Mota, again, on a major secondary road, strategically important because it offered some comfort to the Italians a little further north. So they thought Mota would be a good thing to get rid of. So they trek through this, the 19... plus the two Australians, trek through this. Again, appalling conditions, rain, blizzards, just awful, apparently. The English wrote it up afterwards as being one of the most miserable parts of their campaign. They get to Mota, which is, again, 8,500 feet higher again, so they're suffering from altitude sickness. Anyway, to cut it a little bit short, the Australians get there. They believe the British are sending up support, which doesn't quite arrive on time. They suss the place out. They think, well, fair enough, we'll go back to what we do well. We'll arrive in darkness, we'll attack with everything we've got and try and scare the hell out of them. So they, instead of waiting till the next morning, they actually attack at night, and they bombard it with their mortars all night. And the next morning, the fort's got smoke rising above it, and Alan Brown thinks, well, I don't have a lot of men. I have 21 all up. I don't have a lot of in the way of ammunition, because if we have to spend another couple of days here, we're going to be in deep strife. So Brown, under a flag of truce, goes in to chat to the Italians.
Now, what does he notice on the way in?
He notices he's created an absolute mess of the fort, but still pretty much intact, but just cosmetically looking quite dreadful. Smoke, destroyed things. He's also looking at how the fort's laid out. So if they do have to attack, they've got a fair idea of where they need to head. He's greeted by the Italian commander, I think it was called the Glorious 69th, who's magnificently attired, little fellow in a fantastic-looking uniform, lots of nice medals and braid, and Brown's, you know, covered in beard, slouch hat, and looking like he hasn't slept for a couple of days. They have a discussion. The Italian is very hospitable and invites Alan in for a glass of champagne. He's only got 3 bottles left, but he thought, I might as well share it.
Champagne.
Champagne. The Italians were
in an Ethiopian fort.
It's a beautifully catered war for the Italians. So they have a glass of champagne, and Brown just says, you know, bottom line is, there's a huge force out there. You've heard about the huge force. Rumours had already spread that the British were well and truly entrenched. You want to give up? And the Italian, who I think was trying to keep a bit of face at the time, says, well, come back and we'll have another chat. So anyway, Brown goes back. The battle resumes. The Australians keep lobbing everything they have at it. Supplies are dwindling.
The Italians have no idea, still at this point, they're facing 19 men.
No, they're just... Brown's got them spread out around the fort in this sort of fairly wooded area. So they actually can't see the force. All they know is that they're throwing a lot of munitions their way.
And they're used to dealing with bows and arrows and 19th century rifles, aren't they?
So, this is not some rattling old thing that Queen Victoria once had in her arsenal. These are serious contemporary warfare. And Burke is doing his trick. He's getting in very close to the fort and literally lobbing things over and then running back. So they think, God almighty, what's out there? They also know that Italy isn't quite that as well off in Ethiopia as it used to be. So they're thinking, I presume the Italian overnight has weighed up his options. So Brown goes back the next morning.
More champagne?
No, it was a bit early, so they had tea.
Right.
Alan Brown is a wonderful man. He was very concise, very strong, and very credible. So he spun them this story, and the Italians went for it hook, line, and sinker, and he came back the next day, and the Italian said, well, we give up. So they arrange a very peaceful handover, and the Italians, to their surprise, and I probably think relief, are captured by 21 people led by 2 Australians. The Italians don't think this is such a bad thing. And then the British arrive, of course, a little bit late. And on the first night in captivity, then there's this lovely story. My uncle, the British commander, has finally arrived. He taps on his door, rushes in, says, what the hell's going on, or something like that. The Italian officers are apparently, with some of their native associates, are having a little bit of a orgy. I think it would be reasonable. They're drinking, carousing, and carrying on in a most unseemly way. And my uncle's utterly horrified. What sort of war are we running here? It's very funny.
Get out!
It was probably one of the most civilized engagements of World War II.
So again, this tiny, tiny group of men, 19 or 21 men, I'm not quite sure.
21 men, all up,
managed to persuade a garrison of 2,500 soldiers to stand down.
And then they marched them off into prison.
Oh dear, how civilized. And you got no sense that the Italians were dismayed by having been overpowered by such a tiny group of men?
No, I think after 2 days of constant bombardment and realizing that their number was probably up, broadly speaking anyway, they thought, Let's give it up. And I don't think that their native troops were desperately keen to bat on either.
It's just like, it's the stuff of movies, isn't it, this kind of scene? Except no one would believe it if it was in a movie.
It's genuinely funny.
It's genuinely funny. And it's so out there, you probably wouldn't work in a movie because it just seemed too preposterous.
Exactly.
That's exactly what happened, though. Duncan, what sort of condition were the men in when Mission 101 finally came to its end and Selassie is put back on the throne and the Italians are driven out?
Pretty lousy. I remember chatting to Bill Howe's niece, or great-niece, I'm sorry, and they'd said his sister had sent a photograph of him and said the light had gone from his eyes, which I think is an incredibly touching moment.
Why?
Because they'd just gone through so much in that period. Ethiopia is right smack bang in the middle of the malaria belt.
Am I missing something? Yeah, because the way we're talking about it at the moment, maybe I'm being too glib about it, it sounds like
there's
a lark, but no warfare, stretch of warfare is a lark, isn't
it? So. I found the same thing. There's this wonderful adventure they set off on, which has got these funny moments and moments of absolute horror where they're in hand-to-hand fighting with the Italians as well. But the medical toll on them, apart from the fact that they're spending a chunk of their life being shot at regularly in these most hostile conditions, Ethiopia just screwed them more than anything else. Yellow fever is rampant. They all came down with malaria. They had little sort of ticks that would creep into places you don't really want to find a tick and breed there. It was cold. It was miserable. Their boots were rotting. Their food went from nice dinner parties down to miserable local rations that they scavenged and foraged for. They lost enormous amounts of weight. They were just really solidly beaten. And, of course, a lot of the things they encountered there would keep recurring throughout the rest of their lives. So the counterpoint to the boys' own adventure is the appalling condition they came back in. They were upright and they were functioning. But they contract. I mean, malaria alone is just incredibly disabling.
Nonetheless, they'd inflicted a heavy defeat upon the enemy.
Absolutely.
Using classic instructions from Sun Tzu's Art of War, really. I mean,
it was.
Defeating the enemy through their own perceptions of themselves.
Sun Tzu with just a touch of T. Lawrence thrown in the spice.
Indeed. And how much had this operation cost?
Alan Brown did the accounting at the end, and they went through a lot of munitions, of course, but I think he had a few thousand pounds of these wonderful gold currency, the Maria Theresa dollar, or thaler, as the locals called it, which is... Alan had a pile of those lashed to a mule. He came back, did his accounting, got his receipts together, and his entire, from beginning of January through to May in this campaign, cost the British government precisely £200, all accounted for.
Wow.
It's a cheap war.
That is cheap at half the price, isn't it? Yes. Were the Australians welcomed back after their mission?
No. The mission didn't end well for the Australians. Their leader in the mission, overall charge of the mission, was a fellow called Lord Wingate, who was a character himself. Very irregular, very unconventional, and disliked by the British hierarchy. And so I think a bit of that stain spread to the Australians, who were also his blue-eyed boys. They got on fabulously. They loved their ratbag colonel. He loved them. But the British establishment didn't like them. And I've seen the documents, which is quite fascinating. You see the recommendations for the officers for awards, and Wingate recommended Alan Brown for a military cross and a slew of other officers. Alan Brown was one of the few who didn't get any recognition whatsoever. The others got their awards, good and bad alike. Brown was completely ignored, as were the other Australians.
Because of this... bitchiness in the officer class.
And they were. I'm speculating, but they were Australian. Who cares? They weren't that important. They just did the job we told them to do.
Were our own commanders trying to chase up these recommendations?
Left them cold. Left them absolutely cold. They got absolutely nothing apart from a couple of more months in the Middle East and then a nice ticket to Papua New Guinea for the next couple of years.
Oh, of course, because this all winds up in May 1941.
Yes.
And the Pacific War starts in December.
Yes.
So then they go off to New Guinea. What fate did fate have in store for those five men?
For Bill Howell, it was a very brief future. He was killed in, I think, August 1942 up in the Kokoda. The other four soldiered on. I think Boddy was quite injured. He left the war in about mid-1944, and the other three guys soldiered on till the very end. And they were still fighting 6 years after they'd joined. My uncle, I had a couple of run-ins. He had a run-in with an American general, and we told him a few things, fairly concise. He also had a run-in with the Australian military hierarchy and took the view that having their soldiers killed wantonly wasn't a good idea. So he used language which is somewhat unparliamentary and told his lieutenant colonel where he could go and what he could do when he was there. So instead of being chastised for that, which was normal, he was sent off to the Z Special Forces and was back raising insurrection and all sorts of things in Bougainville.
And that's where he spent the rest of his life.
Yeah, he spent a lot of while. When he wasn't, and a lot of the thing that characterises them all, they still kept fighting on, but the level of sickness, you look at their medical records, and they'd fight for a couple of months, and then they'd be off sick with malaria or some sort of odd disease and hospitalised. So you could see that the physical effect that Ethiopia had taken on them continued through into New Guinea, but they were fighting or recovering.
Now that you've researched this and you know all this about your uncle and found out the stories he told you, outlandish as they were, as a kid, were true, what do you now see in your uncle after all these years later. Do you remember him now? I don't know how you remember him now. Has it affected the way now, has it filled in the, rounded out the picture you have of him?
I was always terribly fond of him because he added a splash of colour into a fairly drab otherwise child's life. I always thought he was remarkable, but in researching this story, you just realise how remarkable these five men were. You know, taken from pretty much from New South Wales for one, transplanted to the Middle East, and then transplanted into this bizarre war in a funny little country that was pretty much unheard of. It's an extraordinary experience. But then to finish that and be sent off to fight the Japanese in Kokoda for the next 4 years, it's spending 6 years getting up every morning knowing that the rest of the day someone's going to be trying to kill you. It's an exceptional life.
Did he remain afflicted by his illnesses for the rest of his life?
Yeah, he came back a very quiet man. Reasonably social, but fairly quiet fellow, and he was always sick. As a kid, I remember on Sundays, one of the regular things we'd do on a Sunday would be to drive out to Concord Repat Hospital to visit him, because he'd be good a couple of weeks, then in hospital a couple of weeks. It was a dreadful life.
And when did he pass away?
1966.
1966.
Curiously, 2 years before Haile Selassie visited Australia for the first time, so the two old mates didn't get to catch up.
Did Haile Selassie ever meet those men?
He invited Alan Brown back. He was celebrating one of his 50 years on the throne or something, a major milestone. And he invited Alan. There were two surviving at that stage, Ted Boddy and Alan Brown. He invited Alan Brown back, all expenses paid trip, and Alan Brown actually then met with Haile Selassie, went to the dinner, reunited with all the old British officers, and took a drive this time up the same road where he was spent so much of his time trying to blow cars up on.
An amazing story. I had no idea that any of this had happened. It's one of those, and yet another one of those extraordinary untold stories of the Second World War and Australia's role in it. And it's so great to have you in here to tell that story, Duncan. Really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you very much, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.